Last week we set the stage. I gave you a ton of historical context, and I introduced a bunch of different people into the story of Pocahontas. We have Wahunsanaka, Pocahontas' father, who was the paramount chief of the Powhatan Confederacy. John Smith, the gun for hire who traversed the Atlantic for God and glory. And of course, Pocahontas, the legendary Powhatan princess who is immortalized in an eponymous 1995 Disney animated film. We've got a ton to go over, so let's just jump right in. My name is Josh, and this is Obscure History. When we left off, the once peaceful relationship between the Powhatan and British colonists had become strained by one of the worst years of drought ever to blister the Virginia landscape. And even worse, the only real leader that the Jamestown colonists had known, John Smith, was injured in a freak gunpowder accident and had to return back to Britain to recover. He never did go back to the colony. Last week we talked a little bit about John Smith's background as a mercenary. And while all of that is true, he did pretty much just go wherever he was paid to kill people, John Smith is actually a much deeper character in the story of Jamestown than you might imagine. You see, the peace between the Powhatan and the colonists mostly came from a mutual respect held between Chief Wahunsanaka and John Smith. Before the worst of the drought came, there was even an agreement made between the two men for the colonists to move to a Powhatan village in exchange for full provision. Essentially, the Powhatan were willing to adopt the English into their society, and at a point it seems like John Smith agreed to this. But then the starving time came, and the Powhatan withdrew to protect what little resources they had, and John Smith, the strongest link between the Powhatan and English, got sent back home. What peace had been established before 1609 basically dissolved over that one horrible year. Supply ships were sent from Britain in 1608. But there was no Amazon Prime shipping in colonial America. The ships were loaded with important goods for the survival of Jamestown, but they also carried a much different and perhaps more consequential type of cargo. In addition to supplies like food, tools, and building materials, the ships also contained hundreds of new settlers and a man who would take the lead in Jamestown in the absence of John Smith. That man's name was Francis West. As the treacherous winter began to thaw away, the Powhatan and Jamestown colonists began making contact again, but not like they had before. In 1609, before the supply ships made landfall, the Pospahegh, a group within the Powhatan Confederacy, began raiding Jamestown and stealing what scraps they had left to survive on. This built up resentment in the surviving colonists, of which there were not many. Between the raids, the drought, and the mismanaged colony, those English settlers that survived had done so by eating their own clothing and even each other. But even those desperate resources were running low. The remaining 60 colonists decided to flee. They couldn't have expected to make it very far, as they were famished and horribly ill, but they decided that a death on the move was better than a death sitting still. So they set out. But after only 2 days, they were met by Francis West and his supply ships, and were ordered to return to Jamestown. And this is where things get very dark. Do be warned, if you continue listening to this episode, there are disturbing things to come. Upon setting up camp in Jamestown, Francis West started the business of getting English property back from the Pospahegh. And, unfortunately for everyone involved, he was not as skilled a diplomat as John Smith. Rather than meet with Chief Wahunsanaka, West initiated an unholy crusade. He first captured some of the Pospahegh who had raided the colony. He then sent word to Chief Wahunsanaka. His message was a ransom. If our property is not returned, we will engage you in war. The response that came back from Wahunsanaka was brief. He said, "Stay in your fort, or leave this land." In reply, West sent back the severed hand of a Pospahegh captive, and with that, the First Anglo-Powhatan War began. West and his men moved on the Pospahegh. They stormed their settlements, burned their crops, stole their children, and kidnapped the wife of the Pospahegh Werowance, a man whom John Smith had a close relationship with. On their way back to Jamestown, the colonists decided to throw the children they had kidnapped into the James River and shoot them in front of the Pospahegh Queen. Once they'd returned to Jamestown, they executed the Werowance's wife publicly. As many as 75 Pospahig were killed in this first attack, and they never recovered. They abandoned their settlements, and only a few months after that attack, Jamestown colonist Thomas Dale reported that their fields had been overgrown by weeds. In response, the colonists were ambushed on multiple occasions. The Powhatan would even lure small groups of colonists out of the fort, only to kill them by surprise in the darkness of the forest, only a handful at a time. This pattern continued for months. The colonists would amass a militia to chase the Powhatan out of a village or town, and the Powhatan would respond by ambushing colonists in the woods. It seemed as if there would never be a resolution. The Powhatan were more powerful than the colonists had expected, but they continued to take key losses at strategic positions, and their resources began to suffer. The conflict was at a stalemate until one colonist named Captain Samuel Argall got an idea. While the majority of the fighting was taking place along the James River, Argall was trying to keep diplomatic channels open with the more inland groups of the Powhatan, and he was fairly successful in doing so. In fact, he was so successful that he was able to learn some interesting information. Through a translator, he learned that Chief Wahunsanaka's favorite daughter would be visiting a nearby village, and that's when the light bulb went off in his head. By this time, Pocahontas was already of marrying age and was allegedly already married to a Powhatan warrior named Kokuam. In fact, it is said that Pocahontas and Kokuam already had a daughter named Kaoke by 1609. Samuel Argall and his men surprised Pocahontas in the village that she was visiting. They took her by force or coercion and returned to Jamestown. Pocahontas, a 13-year-old wife, mother, and favored daughter of the paramount chief of the Powhatan, was captured there for over a year. As soon as word spread of her capture, the fighting stopped. There were tense moments where the Powhatan and colonists would stand off and the urge of violence would boil in their blood, but after Pocahontas's capture, that bloodshed stopped, at least for the time being. The English, understanding the strategic advantage they gained by holding Pocahontas prisoner, used her presence as a bargaining chip. They repeatedly offered ransoms to the Powhatan, but refused to release her after their demands had been met. After about a year, Pocahontas had converted to Christianity, taken the name Rebecca, and was married to a colonist named Thomas Rolfe, who had made a name for himself as a prolific tobacco farmer and merchant. The couple had a child named Thomas and moved back to England, where Pocahontas was paraded around as proof that colonization was safe and effective. While Thomas Rolfe did seem to have a deep fondness for Pocahontas, it is unclear whether or not this was purely a political move by Rolfe and the colonists to bolster support for colonization back home in England, but from the accounts that we have, Pocahontas seems to have been a smash hit in England. It's said that she was entertained as a guest of honor at the theater and was even invited to a personal dinner with King James himself. Pocahontas died while in England from causes that are still unknown. Her body was buried in a Christian cemetery thousands of miles away from the place that she called home. And that's the entire story of Pocahontas. Or is it? There is so much more here than just the sort of notable plot points, but before we get into my favorite type of historical work, we need to pause, take an ad break, and pay some bills. For the next 60 seconds or so, you'll hear from some sponsors, and when we get back, we're going to dive right into some serious and admittedly nerdy and abstract historical study. All right, we're back. Let's get into this. But before we get much farther, I do need to confess something to you. I just told you my version of the Pocahontas story. Don't get me wrong, I used legitimate sources and I have done the appropriate amount of research to present a cognitive narrative to you. But we've got a giant problem. There are many versions of the Pocahontas story. This is actually something that we run into all the time when studying history, especially when studying the intercultural relationships that exist along territorial borders. You see, we've got the English version of the story, but we've also got the Powhatan version of the story. And even further, we have different presentations of those stories. You've got the version that appears in textbooks and schools. There's also different versions that appear in popular culture and entertainment media. And here's a quick spoiler in case you haven't already guessed it. They're all completely different. In the English version, the colonists make landfall, set up their fort, John Smith convinces the Powhatan to give them aid after being kidnapped and saved by Pocahontas, Then the Earth stops producing any kind of usable resource, and all of a sudden the Powhatans stop working with the English and become super hostile. So, in an act of self-defense, the English begin waging war with the Powhatan, which seems perpetual until Samuel Argall makes a deal with a small village of Powhatan people to trade Pocahontas for some copper pans. Then, while Pocahontas is being held in very comfortable accommodations, she learns to love Jesus and dislike the Powhatan. Also, while she's an honored guest in Jamestown, she falls head over heel in love for Thomas Rolfe. They get married, and because their love is so strong, they actually move back to England because Rolfe just can't wait to take home his new bride and show mommy. Then she dies, is buried in a Christian cemetery, and that's the end of it. In stark contrast, there's the Powhatan version of the story, which goes something like this, and please understand I am doing my best to paraphrase a ton of information into a small paragraph because we've got a lot more to get to. It goes a little bit like this. The English colonists make landfall and set up shop in the Forbidden Swamp. The Powhatan realize that this is a terrible place and that the newcomers will almost certainly die without any aid, so they happily provide that aid, and everything is going swell. Chief Powhatan even performs a werewolf ceremony for this John Smith guy. But then the Earth stops producing any kind of usable resource, so the Powhatan retreat inward in order to save themselves. But the English respond by encroaching into Powhatan territory and burning stuff down, which is ironic because it's not like there are a lot of usable resources to go around as it is. John Smith disappears and is replaced by this other guy that holds the Powhatan at gunpoint when trading. He also steals Pocahontas, murders her husband, and they hold her in a dingy jail cell where she is raped by many men every day, and is made pregnant out of wedlock. In order to avoid complete controversy, they force her to convert, force her to marry Thomas Rolfe, and then send her off to England where she is killed by poisoning. On top of that, there's the Disney version, which is so horribly incorrect, I'm not even going to dissect it. So how do you decide what actually happened? How do historians take a subject that has such wildly differing accounts and find any kind of understandable narrative? They do this using the three C's: compare, contrast, and collaborate. I tried my very best to present the narrative to you following those principles. For example, I argued that John Smith wasn't in any danger when he was quote-unquote captured by the Powhatan, and that Pocahontas never saved his life. Here's why I decided to make that narrative point. In John Smith's first accounts, he actually said that he was welcomed into the court of Wahoonsonock with a great feast and was treated incredibly well, which lines up a lot more closely with Powhatan oral tradition. It also lines up with what experts in other disciplines say. Anthropologist and Powhatan expert Helen Rowntree argues that Smith could not have been in danger because the Powhatan didn't have any kind of execution ritual as Smith described later in his life. She also argues that it would have been impossible for Pocahontas to interrupt the execution, even if there was supposed to be one, because as a woman, and a child, she was very strongly prohibited from attending any kind of ritual, and as the daughter of the paramount chief, she would have been watched very closely. So considering all of that, I feel confident saying that John Smith was never in danger and Pocahontas never saved him. Another good example is that I argued that Pocahontas was married and might have even had a child named Ka'oke when she was kidnapped. While it's impossible to prove this, the Mattapone sacred oral tradition alleges it, and English documents from as early as 1616 mention Pocahontas' first marriage and Kokowum by name. As we discussed in the first part of the series, it would have been completely normal for Pocahontas to have a husband and child by 13, so in this case, the three C's check out. However, it's not always that simple. I didn't argue that Pocahontas had been sexually assaulted by the colonists, even though I initially thought that might be true. The colony had way more single men than women, and I originally thought that that fact, paired with the fact that the English saw the Powhatan as subhuman, may lend history toward that narrative. However, Helen Rowntree argues that the English would have feared the power and numbers of the Powhatan and understood the very tenuous position they were in by keeping Pocahontas prisoner. So while it's likely that they didn't treat her as a queen or honored guest the way that the English documents allege, it would have greatly benefited them not to cause her harm. So that's where I put my argument. I could literally go on for hours about how differently history is presented to us, but why does it matter if there are different versions of the story? Well, buckle up, because it matters a lot. To the student, there is nary a source as infallible as the words written in their textbooks and the lessons presented to them by their teachers. Further, the emotional status, level of enthusiasm, and the teacher's interest in subject material can have a very strong effect on how receptive students are to the lessons presented to them. Literally, every single detail about how the past is presented to a student in a classroom shapes the historical narrative they receive. Teachers report a direct correlation between their emotional presentation and their students' behavior and willingness to learn. This is particularly volatile as history is already an interpretive field, and within history education, there exists the possibility for inaccuracies, misrepresentation, and misplaced focus. To the student, their teacher is a trusted adult, an expert in their field who is bestowing upon them the wisdom that they need to advance their academic career. Similarly, the textbooks and curriculum given to them are presented as ultimate sources of wisdom and are unlikely to be willingly supplemented, particularly among younger students. This is of particular importance because Native people are very poorly represented in current curriculum. I have 5 of the most popular American history textbooks in the nation on my desk right now. I purchased the newest versions of each and can personally attest that they do not cover Native history with much interest or accuracy. And the same can be said for any people group that is not directly involved with the imperial agenda of the United States. Generally, each book that I surveyed tells a similar tale. They explain the financial interests of England to colonize the New World, paying especially close attention to England's economic competition with Spain and the invention of joint stock companies. Then, a brief explanation of the colonists' landing and founding of Jamestown is given, often focusing on their misinformed attempts to mine for precious metals rather than establish reliable agriculture. Some books briefly mention the Powhatan or Pocahontas, but they usually jump over most of that section of history to talk at length about the House of Burgesses and the earliest seeds of American democracy. Maybe you're thinking, like, so what? Why does it matter that our current curriculum completely avoids talking about any kind of history that isn't directly related to the United States imperial story? Well, it does matter quite a bit. The omission and misrepresentation of Native people in modern textbooks is harmful to Native students. Native American students experience increased high school dropout rates and suicide completion rates at over 2.5 times that of non-Native students. Additionally, they consistently perform lower than their peers in reading and mathematics, and it's not because they are somehow less capable. To understand this phenomenon, educators must consider the experience of Native students. In her article, Cultivating Perspective, Olivia G. Holter states that microaggressions are one such phenomenon that have been shown to negatively impact the mental health and academic success of minority groups, including Native Americans. Microaggressions are characterized as everyday snubs and slights directed towards minorities. Furthermore, microaggressions are correlated with mental health problems, such as depression. One potential source of microaggressions could be the educational curriculum and discourse, specifically history texts provided within the school setting. And look, before I get too far, don't get me wrong, I don't even think that these slights are necessarily intentional, and I know that you can't blame all of the troubles of a whole people group on something so finite as just history curriculum. But it definitely contributes to a problem. These microaggressions are a result of teaching history through the lens of empire. By omitting important aspects of Native history from general American history curriculum and ignoring the historical trauma experienced by Native students, the very material that is supposed to enrich and engage oppresses and discourages learning. And while I don't have the same data on this, I really believe that this can apply to a whole variety of people groups. You see, the problem with studying history through the imperial lens is that often, regular people stand in the way of imperial progress and can get colored as a hindrance to that progress. In the textbooks that I surveyed, I noticed a recurring pattern. The narrative presented read something like this: Jamestown is happening, but there's all these people in the way. Or, the railroad is happening, but there's all these people in the way. Or, the Civil War is happening, if only these people weren't in the way of this progress. Studying history through the lens of empire is not only harmful to students that are of the groups that are positioned as a hindrance to the progress, it's also very uninteresting and not engaging at all. Consistently, history is reported to be the least favorite core class among secondary students, and it's largely because of the representation of the past students are given. It's stale. Simply studying the past through the imperial lens is boring. Presenting various perspectives of the past not only creates a more inviting learning environment, but it also makes the past more interesting even for students that wouldn't otherwise feel offended by subject material. It's not about being politically correct. It's about giving students the most rich and valuable experience possible, and spending 2 paragraphs talking about the Powhatan and 4 pages talking about the House of Burgesses isn't rich, and it's not particularly valuable. And look, I know I'm naive. I fully admit it. I know that state standards require teachers to move through vast expanses of time and space over the course of a single school year. And admittedly, studying the past through an imperial lens is an extremely effective way to make it through such large timelines. So, do we need education reform? I mean, probably. But that's not my argument right now. And frankly, I don't have any of those answers. Do we need to lobby for better textbooks? No, not really. That's been done for decades, and they never really improve. There are actually studies that are consistently done every 10 years or so to check on that exact thing, and they pretty much always say that history textbooks never change, even after strong political and local lobbying. So what do we do then? To quote historian Tony R. Sanchez, "Not all educators, however, take seriously the mission of accurate cultural depictions, taking for granted that because information is in the textbook, it must certainly be true. This problem will persist as long as social studies educators rely on the textbook as a single source of knowledge." A recent Gallup poll showed that 94% of secondary-level social studies teachers use only one source for their entire year, and over 80% of those teachers use that single source multiple times per week for coursework. We don't need reform or lobbying as much as we need social studies teachers who are willing to put in the extra work to present history in a more vibrant and accurate way. And look, I get it. I know that this takes work and that teachers are already overworked. But it's not like math. Math is math no matter what book you use. But after I personally surveyed these 5 history textbooks, I can confirm that their narratives are not in any way the same. History is an interpretive field, and it needs to be interpreted with care. All right, guys, we have reached the end of this wild ride. I know that we got a little nerdy and preachy there at the end, but I love this kind of historical study, and I thought it would be a fun argument that you would be interested in. I actually pulled almost all of the research from this part of the series from my undergraduate capstone project, and I've had this stuff just like bouncing around in my head for so long. I've also got a bunch of ideas bouncing around in my head about this show. I'm considering starting a book club, maybe. Here's what I'm thinking. I post a link to a book, you buy it, I buy it, we read it together, maybe on like an exclusive feed like Patreon or Apple Podcast subscription or something. Or maybe I read it during the week and then we stream kind of a meetup one day. I don't really know. I'm just kind of brainstorming with myself. Please reach out if any of that sounds fun. I really am considering it, but I need some more feedback from you guys first. I'm stoked to present this week's indie music feature. Today we've got a song called 7x7 by Fair Hazel. This song is absolutely gorgeous. It's got this extremely catchy melody and this atmospheric thing that I just absolutely love. It reminds me of some early From Indian Lakes, who is one of my favorite bands, if any of you guys are familiar. I'm going to link Fair Hazel's stuff in the show description, so go ahead and check it out today. You won't regret it. Okay, I've been Old Man Screams at Clouds long enough. Let's end this one. Oh, also, sorry that I am late. That's my bad. I did not anticipate the holiday because my foresight extends for about 48 hours. So holidays frequently sneak up on me. Anyways, I'm getting out of here. I'll see you guys next week. And I'm going to try to find an extra crazy story just to balance things out. This one was a little nerdy and academic, so maybe next time I'll give you something more exciting.
I think I found my home in silence. Found my peace in empty roads with empty souls just looking for some peace of mind they cannot buy. Back in the busy city where the people are slaves to the hours that make up our night and day. But those who break free are cursed with the knowledge of humanity.
Time wears beauty down to a dull edge.